Hi, it's Dave. It's been about 9 years since the passing of Steve Jobs, and yet the impact of what he's done and brought into the world still have ramifications in our daily lives. In this video, I want to look at perhaps what I think is the key insight that Steve Jobs discovered, and I want to apply it to help us to become better investors. Now, Steve Jobs had a lot of insights on business, on technology, on human behavior, on many different facets. However, I think one of the key insights that he brought that kind of shaped Apple and has given Apple its competitive advantage even until now is this deep understanding of what science and humanities are and how they can be seemingly opposed to each other, yet they're complementary. Let me give you an example. Steve Jobs mentioned over the years that Apple was at the intersection of science and humanities and how they had embraced both and brought them together to create innovative and revolutionary products. Now, this was rather a unique and against the flow understanding of science and humanities. In fact, in the tech industry, science and technology is often uplifted so high, and the humanities and things that don't really make sense with the scientific method or with numbers or math, they're often pushed away and looked down as secondary. However, in Steve Jobs' mind, he saw them not as opposing principles, but rather complementary principles. And I think that was probably one of the keys to the birth of the iPhone, the iPad, and many of Apple's products. In this video clip, here's Steve Jobs explaining that intersection of science and humanities.
It's in Apple's DNA that technology alone is not enough. That it's technology married with liberal arts, married with the humanities, that yields us the result that makes our hearts sing. And nowhere is that more true than in these post-PC devices. And a lot of folks in this tablet market are rushing in, and they're looking at this as the next PC. The hardware and the software are done by different companies, and they're talking about speeds and feeds, just like they did with PCs. And our experience in every bone in our body says that that is not the right approach to this, that these are post-PC devices that need to be even easier to use than a PC, that need to be even more intuitive than a PC, and where the software and the hardware and the applications need to intertwine in an even more seamless way than they do on a PC. And we think we're on the right track with this. We think we have the right architecture, not just in silicon, but in the organization to build these kinds of products. And so I think we stand a pretty good chance of being pretty competitive in this market.
Often people tend to have narrow belief systems, and when they look at two seemingly opposing ideas, then they usually want to deify one and demonize the other. One example is people who are into science and technology think that that's the answer. However, some people who think that liberal arts or humanities or more of a human side is the answer, they'll lift that up and maybe demonize technology. And it takes a lot of humility to get to this place where you can look at two seemingly opposing beliefs and say, wait, I don't understand how these two beliefs can be true at the same time, yet it seems like they are, and you actually are able to hold them both in esteem. This reminds me of something that I talk about on this channel often, which is the quantitative versus the qualitative skills in investing. A lot of people, they try to focus just on one. They're drawn to the math or the numbers or the statistics, and they see their specialty as analyzing numbers. They look at the revenue and the margin and the profits, and they get into the fine line items of every little detail they can, thinking they can understand the company purely based on numbers. And then there's another camp of people who look at a company more qualitatively. They look at the quality of the management or a vision or the strategy, or they look at the product itself or the product owners and the competition. And these qualitative folks think that that's the most important thing to look at in a company. In an early stage high growth company, both the quantitative and the qualitative folks can make huge mistakes. For the quantitative folks, they might look at the numbers and they can't see how this company can actually make a profit and deserve the valuation that they have. However, on the flip side, the qualitative folks might get too excited about the resume of the CEO, where they might get excited about this so-called product innovation or the next thing that this company is going to deliver. And oftentimes it doesn't work out on either side. The quantitative folks might get burned, like in the case of Tesla, because they don't really understand the innovative qualitative side, and they don't understand how Tesla could actually grow into the valuation that they are. On the flip side, the qualitative folks also get burned very often, because sometimes they get so excited about a new technology or a new company, but that company never realizes its so-called potential. And there's a certain level of humility that's required to say, hey, the quantitative skills and analysis are quite amazing and powerful, and yet the qualitative skills and analysis are super amazing as well. And you embrace that side as well. And yet you hold these seemingly opposing beliefs together, yet in high esteem. Some of the best investors in history have had an amazing ability to reconcile their quantitative and qualitative skills together. For Steve Jobs, it was technology or science and the humanities that would lead to amazing breakthroughs in Apple. Steve used these concepts of diving deep into technology and all that it had to offer. And in the 90s, he dived deep into a desktop operating system with his startup called Next. And it brought over a lot of the technology into Apple when he went back into Apple. And he used a lot of the principles and things from the humanities and liberal arts and to bring in design and human empathy and to make his products beautiful and easy to use and just an amazing overall user experience. After the Macintosh and the MacBooks and the iPods, Apple faced an amazing opportunity with the phone. And even a few years leading up to the introduction of the iPhone, there are many people speculating that Apple needed to make an iPhone because they had all of the pieces already there. However, Steve Jobs had this key insight that shaped the direction of the iPhone, and I think still is reaping benefits for Apple today. And his key insight was that with the iPhone, it needed to be so much easier to use than the desktop computer or notebook computer. And the reason being is because of this smaller form factor and because the cost would be so much less and it would be always on a person in their pocket, Steve Jobs realized that it would impact 10 times the amount of people than a regular computer, desktop or notebook computer would. And in that case, it would be reaching out to many different types of people, people that maybe were anti-tech or didn't feel comfortable with the computer. These type of people needed to be comfortable with the phone. And this was in stark contrast to the culture of the day with these smartphones. If you remember pre-iPhone, there was a lot of different companies that were trying to make the ultimate computer phone, right? The smartphone you can stick in your pocket. And it started back in the day with the hit release of the Palm Pilot. It was kind of like the first mainstream personal tech device that you could put in your pocket that went mainstream with a lot of the tech fanatics. However, the thinking and the ethos and the whole strategy of the tech sector at that time was kind of transferring a lot of the desktop computer experience to the phone. So you had to go through a cumbersome process to install applications. You had an immense complex file system that you had to go through. You had to deal with bugs and crashes that happened all the time. And everything about the smartphone experience was clunky, and it kind of mirrored the desktop computer, and yet it was more difficult to use because of the small interface. A lot of people take for granted the iPhone and they think that, oh yeah, it's easy to use because it's a phone. But actually, it's the opposite. If you take a user experience like a desktop or notebook and you shrink it down to a phone, it actually becomes much more difficult to use. And the level of complexity of the user interactions becomes immensely more difficult. So Steve Jobs and his team had a big problem to solve. And their problem was, if we shrink the desktop computer into a small interface, it gets more complex and it's more difficult to use. But how can we reverse that? How can we actually make it super easy? Rather than make it 3 times harder to use, how can we make it 3 or 4 times easier to use? And that's when Steve Jobs and his team basically decided to start with a blank canvas. They decided not to copy other smartphones or other small devices out there. And they decided to look at first principles. Okay, what would be an ideal experience for a user? And through this out-of-the-box thinking, they decided to combine the depthness of science and technology and go very deep with that, but also embrace the liberal arts and humanities and design and bring the best of that and to combine it into something that no one else has seen before. The result was a few amazing breakthroughs. The first was this touchscreen interface. Rather than a clunky keyboard and mouse interface system, you had this elegant scrolling system, and it would bounce and act like it was a physical object. And it was just an amazing thing to do where you could just scroll and see all of the movements so fluid. And Apple focused a lot of their attention to the detail of how this touch interface would work. And it had an amazing amount of art and design, yet it had a depthness of technology and innovation. The second innovation that they brought with the iPhone was the app system. Rather than have clunky programs that you had to install and uninstall and manage with this complex file system, they brought together this simple concept of apps where you just open up an icon and everything would take care of itself. It would launch and keep its files there. You don't have to do anything basically. And to delete the app, you just kind of press it a little bit longer and then you can delete the app. People take apps for granted and that whole concept of an easy to use app. However, back in those days, the concept of running an application was daunting and it was immensely complex. And Steve Jobs, again, he brought together the depthness of technology and the depthness of liberal arts and design and came together with something quite revolutionary. And perhaps the last major kind of innovation with the initial iPhone was they took a desktop class operating system and they basically put it into a small iPhone device. However, this took many, many years and it really drawed into the deep experience with operating systems that Apple had. See, Apple was one of the foremost experts in desktop operating systems. Steve Jobs had created kind of the next generation operating system in the 1990s when he started a company called Next. He brought over that concept into Apple when he went back into the Apple, applied it into Macintosh OS, and brought the whole Macintosh operating system to another level. And after these iterative improvements, Steve Jobs and Apple basically took all of their knowledge with the desktop operating system and they shrunk it down to a mobile operating system, and yet it was a super powerful operating system based on a lot of the principles of a desktop operating system. It wasn't a pared down operating system where you couldn't do much. No, this operating system had the foundation to run almost anything in the future. Apple also leveraged their many years of hardware development. They had built the Macintosh and these awesome notebook computers. And with the iPod, they were making yearly iterative improvements that were amazing. They were design experts with the iPod, but to move that knowledge and experience over to the phone completely made sense. Apple had built over many years amazing products that had built up their hardware expertise, had built up their operating system and their software expertise, and had built up their design and human user interface experience. And it was a no-brainer to put that all together into a phone. And what underlined all of this innovation was the values. And it was the values that we could bring together the depthness and the amazing power of technology and science, but combine it with the depthness of liberal arts, humanity, design, and art, bring it together to make something that was so simple to use, yet so powerful and profound. And that was the introduction of the iPhone in 2007, which probably goes down in our lifetime as one of the most important inventions of our day. In fact, Apple is still riding on that innovation that happened 13 years ago when Steve Jobs introduced the iPhone. And in many ways, people underestimated what the iPhone was because they didn't understand it clearly. They were tricked to think that the iPhone was just like a phone, like any other smartphone out there. In fact, Steve Ballmer, the CEO of Microsoft at that time, famously laughed at the iPhone and insulted his ability to be a competitor to them. However, they fundamentally misunderstood and misinterpreted what the iPhone was. They thought it was just like a gadget, a phone, like any other phone, but they totally didn't see the underlying innovation of the operating system, of the hardware design, of the software and the apps. But most importantly, they completely missed out that Apple had created an innovation. They had shrunk the desktop operating experience into a smaller device without increasing complexity, which is amazing. Yet they reversed it and made it even three times as easy to use than the computer. And so the market that Apple had just opened up with that innovation was immense. And it was the beginning of the smartphone revolution. At that time, there are not many companies that could actually copy Apple. And if you understood it at that time, you'd understand that Apple had an amazing lead in terms of their innovation. In fact, one of the companies that could copy Apple in terms of the software side was Google. Google had immense software chops and they put their focus on it to kind of copy the operating system with Android so that Apple wouldn't have a monopoly on the smartphone industry. And they even made the whole operating system free, right? They couldn't compete with Apple on the hardware side, so they had to partner with other manufacturers. It was this key insight from Steve Jobs where he embraced the depthness of science and technology, but he also embraced the humanities and the liberal arts and art and design. And he pulled all of this together in a masterful way. In fact, in a way where he just said, hey, science and technology and art and humanities and design, I'm not sure exactly how all this works together, but yet we're gonna esteem them both. And by esteeming them both, we're gonna come up with some product that's gonna be amazing in both ways, both technologically, but also both in terms of ease of use and the human side of it. A good modern day comparison, even though it's implemented in kind of a little different way, is the case of Elon Musk and Tesla. With Elon, he kind of embraces the science and technology, yet he has this acknowledgement that that alone is not gonna do enough. The technology and the science needs to be accessible, it needs to be easy to use, it needs to look good, and it needs to be compelling for people. That's why with the Roadster, it just looked good with the Model S and Model 3. These are all amazing vehicles aesthetically, but also ease of use. You just step in and you just know how to drive the car because there's no complexity involved. Yet on the deeper level, these are immensely complex technological devices that completely wipe out the complexity of IC vehicles in terms of technology. When you walk into a Tesla vehicle, you don't see and you're not exposed to the complexity of the software and all of what operates this car. You're just enjoying the car car experience. You're enjoying driving and you're enjoying the minimalist space in the car. And this kind of insistence that Elon has on both the science technology side and the humanities side kind of shows up in a lot of the products. For example, with the Powerwall, it just looks good and it's just made to work. For example, the solar roof is just supposed to look like a roof, you know, like beautiful and even more compelling than a regular roof. And if you look at the upcoming Starlink IPO, the whole concept of Starlink with the satellite internet is that you have this super easy to use pizza box type of satellite dish where you just press a button and you get internet. There's no complexity involved. Yet to get there and the infrastructure, the foundation is extremely complex on the back end. Can you imagine how complex it is to launch thousands of satellites into orbit and actually connect them to create a planetary internet constellation? Like, this is immensely complex stuff. Yet to the end user, it's just going to be so easy to use. And that's kind of the combination of science and technology and the humanities, bringing them together so they mesh into a product that's compelling and easy to use. I think actually it's a unique ability to be able to hold kind of the science and technology and the humanities and the human side together in one hand. In fact, a lot of times people look at them as opposing values. However, it's not just with science and technology and humanities. Oftentimes there's things that are so logical and rational. And then there's another side where there's something so intuitive and yet they seem so polar opposite and they are diametrically opposed to each other. But yet sometimes there's a humility to just accept, wait a minute, maybe both of these can be true. Oftentimes we're just looking for quick answers or quick frameworks. So just believing in science completely just makes sense and we just dive into it. Or believing in humanities or liberal arts side just makes sense that we just dive into it and reject other things. And a lot of times it's easier just to accept something that's smaller, more narrow, because we can more fully understand it. And rather than poking and questioning and trying to unravel things, sometimes we take the easy approach out. We say, oh, I'm tired. I don't want to ask questions. I don't want to push hard. I just want to accept. And it's the whole thing of compliance, where we're just so ingrained from a young age to just accept the things that we're taught. When Steve Jobs came back to Apple, one of his first things was to instill a mindset that was different than the past. See, the mindset that Apple had started to adopt when Steve Jobs was away was more of a traditional mindset, a conventional mindset, a narrow thinking mindset. Because of that, there was a stalling of innovation and great products out of Apple. Steve Jobs knew that he needed to fix the mindset. He needed to reset the mindset to help people take the next level so that they could innovate and so their products could be great. And the way he did it was he created a new ad campaign. And the ad campaign wasn't necessarily for the public at large. Rather, it was mostly focused actually to the employees and to the culture of Apple. He wanted their thinking to be elevated to a new level. Steve Jobs' ad campaign was about the crazy ones. He talks about the outliers, the misfits, the rebels, the people who just don't fit in the box. They question, they poke, they unravel, and they create new things because of that. They're not just going with the flow, but rather they're going with their heart. And this kind of combination of bringing all these things together kind of formed the essence and the foundation of Apple's thinking. What Steve Jobs was trying to instill in the culture of Apple was, we're not gonna think inside the box. We're not gonna think just like tech folks who just come up with these boring products or these complex products or these hard to use products. We're not gonna just think about, you know, on the humanities or liberal arts side. No, we're gonna think outside of the box. We're gonna bring together things that don't even seem like they can be brought together. And we're gonna come up with innovative ways to solve people's problems in ways that maybe other people aren't even thinking about. And I think a lot of this actually applies to investing. See, there's a traditional and a conventional way to invest. And oftentimes that's a box. And you're looking for mediocre returns. And oftentimes it's a fear-driven, short-term focus on investing. And this kind of permeates the whole investing world and the whole finance world. And there's a rare time where people can question that and poke the holes and say, wait a minute, is that the best way to do it? Maybe there's a better way. Maybe by embracing the quantitative, and maybe by embracing the qualitative, maybe by holding things that seem opposing, but yet you're just comfortable and humble enough to just accept that perhaps these two things are not diametrically opposed, like maybe it appears to be, but maybe they're complementary in some way. And by accepting kind of more of a broader point of view, you can apply these principles and perhaps understand trends more easily. You can see and understand the core of a product more clearly because you're not just looking at it from a science technology perspective or from a qualitative humanities perspective, but you can see both sides together. It's kind of like rather than seeing one angle, you're seeing it from the head's angle and from the tail's angle. And because of that, you're able to get a bigger picture of it. When Steve Jobs introduced the iPhone in 2007, I instantly knew that this was going to be a massive hit. I thought it was going to be perhaps one of the biggest hits in our entire lifetimes in terms of technology products. And I was understanding their software, I was understanding their hardware expertise, and I was understanding their design expertise. And I knew that if Apple brought that all together, that Apple would have an amazing device that would lead to tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of people purchasing it and adopting their products. When Steve Jobs went on that stage in early 2007, he actually showed pictures and videos of this iPhone and demonstrated it. It was far beyond what I thought Apple could do at that time. Because of kind of my background of understanding the quantitative and the qualitative, embracing the science and technology on a deep level, but also the humanities on a deep level, that I had an appreciation I could see more clearly what Apple was doing with their products. And this can also give me an advantage to spot those big winners, those big 10x generational companies that are just revolutionizing product categories and creating new products and new markets along the way. If you haven't subscribe to my channel, please do so. We're trying to look at investing in other topics through a deeper lens, not just follow the herd and not just react based off of emotions or shallow reasons. Rather, we're trying to go beyond and get deeper and trying to understand things for what they really are and use that as an advantage so we can understand the world and the things around us. The rest of the time, I'm going to answer a question from a viewer. This question comes from Two Music Lover. The problem with Coca-Cola and Tesla in the early days is that for every one of those, there are hundreds that do not make it, so the odds are against the average investor. Most are not able to make the deep dive that you did with Tesla. For example, I work in the nonprofit charity sector. My wife and I gave up lucrative professional careers to do that and have no regrets. Our time is so packed that we have not found time to delve into the realm of investing. Life is meaningful and rewarding. However, I'm starting now in the midst of our schedule and determined to make a go of it and want to equip my sons to do so. But even so, I'm not sure that I'll ever have the time to do the type of deep dive you do. So I'm dependent on some of the analysis and following YouTube videos such as yourself. May I ask, how much time do you devote to doing these type of research study? Thank you. All right, thanks for the great question. I think there's actually a lot of interesting things that you bring up here. First is kind of like the challenge if you don't have enough time to do the research for a deep dive into a company. I think if that's the case, then it's probably wiser to kind of take a more conservative approach with investing, because if you can do a deep dive and you really have the deep quantitative and deep qualitative skills, then you're able to kind of offset some of the risk that comes with investing. However, if you don't have the time to actually do that deep dive, then your risk actually increases when you invest in individual companies. The second thing I want to point out is kind of following other people's opinions. Some people think that you can just kind of watch videos or read articles and that can substitute from your own research. And I think there's some limitations to that. And let me explain. I think there's a big danger of being swayed by other people's opinions. A lot of times we're so impressionable by others. And the problem comes because very few people have real clarity in terms of what they're seeing. Oftentimes it's muddled and it's confused and it's very complex and they're still trying to figure things out. And that's fine for them in their own process and journey, but for that to influence a lot of people's thinking, I think there's actually a better way to go about it. My preference is to go to the source data, actually kind of ignore and block off all of the people's opinions and articles and whatever is out there. And I like to just go to the numbers. I like to go just to the product. I like to go to the CEO, to the strategy, to thinking, to the documents that the company produces themselves. And the reason why I want to do that is I'm trying to get an objective view on this company. I don't want it to be biased by other people's thoughts or emotions. See, a lot of times people get excited about a new company. They see a product, they see a CEO, they see something, some potential. Every company has potential out there and they pump it up and you get into this echo chamber where we have all these excited fans pumping up this company or this product or this stock, and you think it's gonna go to the moon. However, usually they're underestimating the complexity of how difficult it is really for an innovative new company to cross over and to become mainstream. I'm gonna be talking about this in future videos, but this concept of crossing the chasm, going from a niche product to a mainstream product is extremely difficult. And most companies, they can't make that jump. But as an exceptional investor, you need to have a discernment to be able to say, okay, this company has a certain amount of probability. And it's usually not black and white. It's usually like not 0% or 100%, but there's different probabilities of different companies being able to cross over from a niche product to a mainstream product. And what are the factors involved? And a lot of times it takes a lot of clarity, and the masses and the herds just don't have that clarity. I thought of this saying this morning, the bulls are the herd, the bears are the herd, but the exceptional investor takes the lonely path. Yeah, it's probably not what a lot of people want to hear. You know, they want to hear the easy way out, the easy path to investing to great gains. However, I think it's a lonely path, and it takes really an immense amount of clarity and developing skills and a breadth and a depth of understanding. However, since we do live in the day of the internet, maybe there's some exceptions where some of these lonely kind of path investors, these exceptional investors who kind of think outside of the box and who aren't influenced too much by the herd and the noise of society and culture, maybe there can be an opportunity for these people to get together into a smaller community where they can help each other out to make clearer and better decisions. I'm not sure if actually that's the best way or not, but who knows, maybe it's an idea and opportunity. All right, I want to close my video here. Please go ahead, share this video with others on Reddit, on Facebook, on forums, to your friends. It's going to help get the word out. I also want to encourage you to leave a comment, ask any questions you have. I'm reading most of these comments, and oftentimes I'm pulling these questions and kind of making these questions kind of a centerpiece of this video, but also of this channel. So please go ahead and interact and input, and it's going to help us out a lot. Anyways, have a great day, and we'll see you in the next video. Thanks.